of the nations as they develop, and nations like Assyria, nations like Babylon, and locations where they were, and the Grecian Empire, of course, the Persians, and then ultimately the Roman Empire. Now you're almost at the New Testament time frame. So if that gives you a little insight to my madness or methodology, that's where I'm at in my own mind right now. So, all right. Everybody's doing okay. All right. Okay, so last Sunday morning, we ended on this particular slide portion of the study talking about land during the days of Joshua. And this is, of course, the Jordan River Valley, some pictures of what it can be like today. It's dry. That is the Jordan River down in that low area, a part of it. You know, there's quite a bit of a stretch. Here's another modern-day picture of the farming and such that goes along that valley area. The river still flows from the Sea of Galilee, you know, all the way into the Dead Sea. So fresh water. Might be interesting to you to see that flow. Sea of Galilee is a freshwater reservoir. Fishing is still there. But when you get to the Dead Sea, what's going on with that? I mean, it's salt. And is there any fishing going on in the Salt Sea? No. So, it's kind of interesting. Anybody have any idea how deep the Dead Sea is? They don't know. From what I understand, am I wrong on that, Don? I don't think they know how deep it is because of the salt and it's difficult. I don't know if they've got new technology. Someone can find out, trivia question, do some research. But from last I understood, it's difficult because of the actual, it's salt. The content of that water is very rich. But anyway, this particular slide kind of puts into perspective the potential crossing of the Jews and then to Jericho. And I like the way that picture kind of puts a Jericho on an ancient type of hill setting, which is the way it was likely set, as they have done a lot of digging and archaeological research. You can see how it's kind of set up. There were two walls that they have found. It would be that first wall that they were able to, the wall would lay down after they would march around that city and, of course, give them the victory and be able to enter into that city. And we've talked about that. Let's talk about the Promised Land now, just a little bit more in detail. We talked about this some Sunday as well. We looked at these passages where God had told Israel not to take their brethren's land, the Moabites, Midianites, and they were told to leave along the Moab and the Ammonites. And the Ammonites and the Midianites weren't too friendly to them as they were making their passageway through, and God will not forget that, and the consequences of their actions will be severe going toward and forward in the future. But this will kind of show you what will be eventually distributed with regard to the land of promise. Those particular color-coded areas will give in detail the tribes. The southern kingdom would be represented in the south. When the kingdom would divide during the days of Rehoboam and Jeroboam, the northern kingdom represented in the north. Remember that those northern tribes up north, Manasseh, Gad, Reuben, to the east of the river Jordan, and everything from Ephraim, Dan, and on up, Benjamin, Judah, and Simeon, that part of the land will stay in what is known as the southern kingdom and will not be taken captive by the Assyrians. But early on, we get there, and we're going to try to make some time here in the next couple of weeks. Remember, the Assyrians will take captive that northern kingdom because of their apostasy, their unfaithfulness, due to idolatrous worship in primarily at Dan and Bethel, and setting up idolatrous worship in Dan and Bethel. God will tell them through the prophets that they're going into captivity, and they're never going to come back. They will go into captivity and become what will be known as the Samaritans primarily. We get to the New Testament. The Samaritans are those half-breed Jews that don't have any record of their genealogy. They just know that they have some connection. They were intermingling with the world, the Assyrians. So remember we talked about Gad and Reuben, they wanted to take the land east of the Jordan before they actually crossed over the Jordan. And Moses, the Lord, was a little bit, he was angered, but they guaranteed they would go into the land of promise and fight with their brethren and take the land of promise, and they will. But I pointed out last week, and I want you to remember this, that if you study your Bible, you'll understand that in haste, perhaps making that decision, Gad and Reuben will be the first tribes that are taken by the Assyrians. They are the least secure, they are the least fortified, and historically speaking, they will be besieged and they will be taken by the Assyrians. And perhaps again, because of their impatience crossing over the actual Jordan, that is a result of their choice. So you have to think about long-term choices. You know, when you make choices today, and I want to say this because there's application in our lives. How many times have you known Christians to make decisions in their life to move to a foreign town, a foreign state, take up a good job that pays well, but the last thing on their mind was the church? Is the Church of Christ in this city? And they get up there, and all of a sudden they realize, wait a second, I got this nice big fancy house, I've got a nice job, but there's no church. There's no people. Or it's maybe a major liberal congregation or a radical situation or something to where they're not doing their research and putting God first before they make all their decisions. Brethren, that's a part of our life as Christians. Before we move, before we go places, are you counting the cost? Are you thinking about where you're going, what you're doing? Can you be faithful? Will you be able to serve God faithfully? Are you ready to be a missionary? Perhaps you have that capacity. I would not say it's sinful or wrong to go into a foreign country or land if you want to do that and there's no church, but are you prepared to become the church of which you are and to start evangelizing every Sunday, setting up time to study, and trying to then build the church? Do you have that capacity? So we need to think about our motives when we move around. Again, these are just some consequential things to consider. Again, another picture of ancient Jericho. This is Joshua chapter 6, by the way. Of course, this, you know, categorizes things in Bronze Age and so forth. You had the Stone Age and all that stuff, and that's the way that they like to categorize things. By the way, do you know why they call it the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and then, of course, into the Iron Age? Yeah. What do you find around here on the ground all the time? If Arrowhead, and what would they be attributed to in one sense if you're purely basing that upon tools and timing? That's stone, right? Mineral? Yeah. So, anyway, you can think about some of that. Some of that's just a way of classification. Don't put a whole lot of stock in that, because I would suggest unto you that when Custer was taking his last stand up on, they had guns too, right, those Indians? But they also had bows and arrows, and those arrows weren't all iron. They were still made out of that chert, that flint, that rock. So again, I wouldn't classify the 1800s per se as Stone Age, would you? Do you see how some of that kind of conflicts with the, if you're just looking at classifications in a black and white manner? You can't really do that. Alright, so again, ancient Jericho toward the end of the Bronze Age. Archaeological excavations reveal that Jericho was violently destroyed sometime toward the end of the Bronze Age. The walls seem to have been thrown down by sudden force as if by an earthquake. Charred wood shows that what was left of the city was burned. Excavators have also found food supplies buried in the destroyed city, which shows it was not captured by siege. So what happened was a rapid situation. What we read in the Bible was a rapid situation. 7 days, 7 days, and that city was taken. And that kind of gives you an interesting, this is of course, this drawing, or this is according to archaeological dig and research as they've excavated that particular ancient city or tell of Jericho. So, kind of interesting. It's one of the well-established archaeological digs. Anybody know why they started looking for Jericho and why in particular one of the archaeologists, which I forget his name, Sir or something or another, he sought after this location for a reason. And do you know why his reason or what his reason was? His motivation? Was it to prove or disprove the Bible? Disprove. In fact, archaeology in and of itself began as a study to prove or disprove the Bible. To disprove. And what has archaeology continually proven? Yeah. And archaeologists who sought out to disprove this stuff have been honest. Most, I would say most that I'm aware of, have been honest and said this matches with what the Bible says. What we find here is what we cannot dispute the Bible. We don't know everything. You know, they obviously would not show complete humility and accept the Bible, but they cannot disprove the Bible. And that's the point here. Bible geography, Bible archaeology, Bible history, all these classes really go hand in hand. It's all scientific. What is science all about? If you think about it, what's the difference between science, scientific law, and scientific theory or hypothesis? What's the difference? That's right. That's right. That's right. But once a hypothesis becomes proven, it becomes what? It becomes a law, which is evidence. And that's when the evidence always coincides with the Word of God. Right. Well, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like the springs and so forth that burst forth during the flood of Noah's day. And we weren't there, were we? But what happens often, even today sometimes, springs do what? You get enough water in certain parts of the world, you get an earthquake over here, and all of a sudden you got water bursting out of the ground somewhere else. There was a major, this is geological, I guess, I suppose. To me, it's all kind of similar and the same. It's hard to escape one from another. But there was a spring they call the Blue Hole up in the Ozarks of Arkansas, I believe. And there was a major earthquake thousands of miles up around Alaska, I believe. And at the same time, simultaneously, this blue spring started belching up ice and all kinds of stuff from under or something. And it was purely and clearly connected. There's some type of a geological thing going on. The point being is who created this world? Who's in control of all things? If he wants to by the word of his mouth, point his finger, however you want to say that, metaphorically speaking, and cause major destruction, he has the authority to do that, right? And we're not going to stand in his way. And so, anyway, again, so archaeology or whoever's going to go do their research, they're going to say, oh, these walls, yeah, they fell in all right, but we don't know how that happened. Well, of course you don't. I wasn't there when the world was created, and neither was Adam and Eve. Have you ever thought about that? Adam and Eve weren't there when it was created. When did Adam and Eve become a reality? On what day? The sixth day, and guess what? God put them on the earth with food. If they'd have done that about 3 days before, they might have gotten hungry. Hurry up, God. We need something here. We're starting to get hungry. Well, we don't even know what this means, but our bodies are saying, give me something. Anyway, God put them on the earth at the right time, at the right place, just as He designed it. And you know, there's so much involved with this. You know, learning to be content with whatsoever state you find yourself in, as the Bible teaches. And it's such a wonderful principle. Anyway, trying to make some time. These are some of the ancient findings. It's hard to kind of decipher some of this. But that is the location there at Jericho. I want to talk about this a little bit as we move to the next screen. We didn't get to this on Sunday, and so now we're kind of back where we started, or where we finished. When you get to the book of Joshua, there are, if you study the book of Joshua, sometimes what are referred to as central, southern, and northern campaigns. And that just means they go to the central part of the promised land, which would be Jericho, Ai. They go to third, or next, to Hazor, north, the northern campaign. And then south, they go down to Eglon, Lachish, and or Lachish, Hebron. And you've got these various campaigns. And so as you read through the book of Joshua, you'll see how that kind of unfolds. And some of these locations are, again, still available. So kind of keep that in mind as you study through the Bible. Here's another slide that might be a little bit more graphic. I don't know if you can see that back there or not. This shows you some, the green is the route of the Exodus. The other is the route of the conquest. And here you have them going into various locations, again, central, northern, and southern campaigns, taking out these cities and these locations. I want you to notice on this particular map, as we get to the book of Judges, you notice over here to the west, along the Mediterranean or Great Sea, the city of Gaza and Ashkelon and Joppa, those areas are highly concentrated with the Philistines. And the Philistines are seafaring people, perhaps like your Navy people of the day. They're pretty tough people, apparently, and yet pretty wicked people. These are some of the people and locations where Samson has a problem with women. Remember, we get to Samson in Judges 16 and so forth. But Samson, through God, through Samson, will use Samson, though, again, not the perfect example for your children to follow. Okay? I don't want my son growing out long hair. I don't care what society says. But, you know, if his strength is in that and God, you know, that's, I'm not, anyway. But nonetheless, Gaza, Ascalon, Joppa, some of those areas, and God uses Samson to judge, hence the name Judges, the people of the Philistines. And he does it almost in a mocking way. Have you ever thought about that? In the book of Judges, what kind of a story is the book of Judges all about? Is it a good time or a bad time for God's people? He sends them a judge and they kind of get their act together for a certain time, but they, what are they doing? What is one of the key principal passages in the book of Judges? They did what was right in their own. And God uses less than perfect people in the book of Judges to judge. They had a judge, didn't they? Like they had a king when they get to 1 Samuel. And God will give them a king too. And that's a good point, because what will God give us perfectly come about 4 BC? He'll give us our king. He'll give us our judge. Which the word judge means what? In the Hebrew, it also can be translated what? Savior. Sometimes it's translated Savior. He sent them saviors or judges. Samuel. Samuel was the last judge and prophet. He judged the people of God. Eli was like a priest and a prophet, and yet he also was one judging the Israelites. And both Samuel and Eli, what kind of family life did they have? What kind of families did they have? Do you remember? Remember Eli's sons? Okay, and then Samuel comes into the place of Eli or as a judge, and then Samuel's ready to hand it over to his sons, and what do the Israelites or the people of God say? Well, we've had enough. And even though they asked for a king, God predicted they would ask for a king. Let me give you a little Bible insight just to remind you. If you want to, look at Deuteronomy 17 for a moment. As we're talking about this and kind of painting the picture, look at Deuteronomy 17. This will kind of get us through the book of Joshua, but and up to. Do you remember what Deuteronomy 17 is really talking about? Someone, look at verse 14. And notice what is said here. And this is Moses before he dies, and he's writing the law, and he doesn't get to go into the land. And he writes and says, about 500 years later, you guys are going to ask for what? And he writes about this. Now, as you read through these qualifications of what a king must be, I want you to ask yourself the question, which of the kings that God appoints fulfills these obligations? And these are not suggestions here. These are obligations. Look at verse 14. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me. Kind of wonder why Samuel got mad. Was it just because they were rejecting his sons? Had Samuel not read his Old Testament law or his law? Had he forgotten this was in there? Or was he realizing, wow, this is a reality right now during my time? It's something I think we ought to think about. So he says, Moses writing, verse 15, thou shalt in any wise set him over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Don't go back into sin, is the idea. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold, and it shall be when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom. Notice how it says, whose kingdom there? His kingdom, which implies something, by the way. Let me show you another passage in the Bible. Look at 2 Samuel for a moment. And let me get this right. Look at 2 Samuel chapter 7. And I suppose this is preparing us for the rest of the geography class, I hope. Verse 11. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 11. Now just remember, Deuteronomy 17, talking about that kingdom that they would call for, it would be his kingdom, right? Now, I think the language here is interesting in 2 Samuel 7, verse 11. Look at verse 11. And as since the time God talking, or Nathan the prophet talking to David, King David, and as since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies, also the Lord telleth thee that he will make thee an home. And when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall produce or proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Need to pay attention to that language. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart from away from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so did Nathan speak unto David. Now, who are we talking about? You can obviously see Solomon in some of this. But whose kingdom would be established forever? Whose kingdom in the New Testament is called Thou Son of David? And who are they talking about? They're not talking about Solomon, are they? You see, all these earthly kings, whose king would commit iniquity and be chastened severely with the rod of men and so forth? Solomon or Christ? Christ didn't commit iniquity. You have to think about some of the language here, but this is no doubt, obviously, y'all have heard this before, this is messianic. There's obviously some hints of what would happen through Solomon's reign, but would Solomon's kingdom last forever? Let me ask you this question. What would happen to Solomon's kingdom, in fact, when Solomon would set up Rehoboam? What happened to that kingdom? It divides. What did Jesus say? A house divided cannot stand. You see, Jesus' house stands because it cannot be divided. You see, Jesus' rock is eternal, solid. Thou art the Christ. And Jesus says, upon what? I will build my church. You see, all that messianic hope and promise that we rely upon, it's all spiritual. And this is what they lacked in the Old Testament. It's what people lack today. They don't understand that I don't stand upon concrete. I don't stand upon dirt. I stand upon Christ, or I fall. It's that simple. I don't care if I'm in the air 15,000 feet flying across the Grand Canyon looking down, I'm still standing on Christ. I cannot fail. I cannot fall if, conditional, I stand on Him. And that's my King. That's your King. He's the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. And so, again, all of this developing surrounding this land and so forth. So let's look at this last slide here on the screen. This, I should get my pointer out, I guess. I forgot that. Over here to the right again, you've got the land layout that will be divided. In Joshua chapter 12 through 13, you see the division and the chronicling, if you will, of the tribes and the land given to them. And it's given just as God said they would inherit it. Now, I also want you to notice on the left side over here, the area occupied by Israel after the conquest. You see the white? The white represents what was not conquered. There is still a lot of house cleaning that must be done. And that doesn't take place until David, King David. So all this white to the left, especially Gaza, Ascalon, Ashdod, Ekron, Gath, or it'd be, well, never mind. But Eglon, Gaza, Gerar, all of that would be heavily concentrated by the Philistines. And those Philistines cause a lot of problems. In 1 Samuel chapter 4, you get into trouble with the Ark of the Covenant, and they're over here warring, and they lose it. They lose the Ark of the Covenant, and they don't get it back till King David. And so, it's not until King David, and this is why David is not a perfect man, but this is why David is called a man after God's own heart, in part. Because David finishes the job. Brethren, one of the things I learned when I studied my Bible is that God doesn't like it when we don't finish our course. You ever thought about that? I don't think they finished. I think Joshua had done all Joshua could do. I think Joshua says exactly what is truthful when he says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, and the people say we will too. But Joshua in Joshua 21 says, the Lord's given us the land, but the job wasn't quite finished yet. Joshua knew that they had to keep fighting, but Joshua was getting to be an old man. He dies. In Judges chapter 1, the tribe of Judah is put over the nation of Israel. It's put over as to lead them to march into battle. Look at Judges chapter 1. Judges chapter 1. And here we see the end of the legacy, if you will, continued of Joshua. Look at verse 1, Judges 1:1. Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, very faithful here, just like they had said in Joshua 24, Notice there in Joshua 24, in verse 16, when the people answered Joshua and said, God forbid that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. All right? You start Judges chapter 1, and they're right there. We're not going to forsake God. We're going to continue doing what's right. So they asked the Lord, saying, who shall go up for us against the Canaanites first to fight against them? Right there it says they have to continue the fight. And they're asking, and the Lord answers and said in verse 2, Judah shall go up, behold, I have delivered the land into his hand. I have delivered it into Judah's hand. Now, by the way, it doesn't take place in this book. Judah doesn't finish the job. But guess who of the tribe of Judah will finish the job? We've already mentioned his name. King David, who is of the tribe of Judah. So I don't believe, of course, God doesn't lie, and God knew exactly what he's talking about here. And so it says in verse 4, Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites, the Perizzites, into their hand, and they slew of them in Bezek 10,000 men, and they found Adon Bezek in Bezek, and they fought against him, and they slew the Canaanites and the Perizzites, but Adonai Bezek fled, and they pursued after him, and caught him, and cut off his thumbs and his great toes. Can you imagine, anybody, you lost a limb, a finger, a toe or something, does it affect your ambidextrous qualities? I've seen guys that have lost their thumbs roping cattle. And that thumb gets, they get on that dolly and that thumb, that calf jerks, and that's why they wear a cotton glove sometimes to help that rope slide off. They don't mean to. It's just where it happens. You know, they get that thumb caught there and on that slack. And I've seen them say, it's tough making it without this. That thumb's important. I know people who've lost other, and you might have problems staying stable on your feet and falling. Again, these people knew what was going on. And they're judging. And Caleb's involved here in verse 12. And then while you look at this, you say, well, this is all fine and dandy and great. And yet it doesn't take long. Look at verse 10 of chapter 2. Look at chapter 2, verses 6 and following, actually. Judges chapter 2, verse 6 and following. And when Joshua had let the people go, the children of Israel went every man into his inheritance to possess the land, And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the mount of Ephraim, on the north side of the hill Gaash. And also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them, which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. Verse 11 says, and the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam. Now, make a few comments here. How many generations does it take to turn away from the Lord? You know, something I've been kind of watching. This is me and my experience, okay? You guys have your own, and we're all together on this one, I'm sure. But do you remember when we lived in a world without social media, cell phones? When people, if they wanted to get a hold of you, had to come find you, come knock on your door, write a letter. Took a little time, didn't it? We are starting to experience a generation now that has lived saturated with social media. That has lived with it. And that's all they know. In some ways, you can't fault them because they don't know any different. But their reality centers around and behind a computer screen. And even through college, they go to college, it's still study, 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 book, it's not really. But now they're going to application. They're going into the world. And you've actually got to pick something, you actually have to do something. Besides, do this, reply here, forward this. And there's two different worlds going on. There's a world that's real, it's always going to be here. And there's this world over here. The social media. Now, all I'm saying is, we're watching. We're watching. Because what does God judge us on? He judges us on our actions, right? What we actually do, how we follow through, what we accomplish. John 15:8. Anybody remember in your memory verse class, John 15:8? Boy, I do. It was Johnny Ramsey who taught it to me. And now I forgot. Hereby we glorify God by the fruits we produce is what it's talking about. But that's what it says. If you don't produce fruit, not so, talk, fruit. Herein is where we glorify God, that we produce much fruit. Produce much fruit. Are we being fruit producers? What are we doing? Let me ask you another question. Can you look back on your life and say, as a Christian to this day, you know what? I'm not saying, this had nothing to do with arrogance or pomp or pride, but can you look back on your life and say, you know, I've been doing something. It's been hard. But there's some fruit to show for this thing. You know, think about it. We don't live in a theoretical world. And I would suggest unto you, in Judges chapter 2, the generation that grew up and knew not God were the generation that were eating the milk and the honey, and they got comfortable, they got complacent, and they forgot that there was a generation 1, 2, 3 back that was actually engaged in bloodshed. Cutting toes off and fingers off to judge the other nation, and they didn't want anything to do with that. That's too mean, critical, and harsh. Can't do that. And they got soft. And I'll say this. I can remember talking to World War II grandparents that are dead and gone now. And I wanted to know, thirsty, tell me about that, Papa. Tell me about that, Papa Markham. And they'd hang their head low and they'd say, you don't want to know about that, son. I hope you never have to experience that, son. But we still call that the greatest generation. And I think so for a right reason. We're so far removed from certain things, and if we're not careful, we're going to forget God. I mean, all it takes is one generation. One generation. So don't forget that. I try to teach my kids that every day. You don't have to have everything you think you want, son. Dad, I want a pair of sunglasses. Dad, I need this. Dad, I want that. I want to be just like that. Son, you don't need all that. What you need to do is get out there and perform. Show me. Show me. By your fruit that you love what you're doing. That's not what makes you successful. Show me. And it works to this day. For 5, 6 years, I've been playing baseball. It's baseball season. And my son has wanted them rope necklaces and them sleeves, and I, for the life of me, don't understand why that makes you a better baseball player. I gotta have some sunglasses, Dad. All my friends have Oakleys and these parents buy that stuff. I don't know where they get the money from. I don't think I'm poor, but nonetheless, you ever seen the price of them things? Son, why can't you just get a pair of them cheap sunglasses? Well, Dad, they don't say Oakley on them. Jaden's 12 years old. And I made a compromise with him last night. because it's bright out here in West Texas, I'll admit. And the sun's pretty tight. I said, son, will you settle for a pair of Field and Stream sunglasses? They're cheaper. And your dad can wear those, and I'll be happy with it. He said, that's fine, Dad. So we went with Field and Stream. You can buy those at Walmart. So, you know, we just have to keep things in perspective, don't we? And this land here and this geography is somewhat of a distraction. Distraction to the people of God. And I don't want this Bible class to be a distraction. I want you to know the principles that are going to save your soul, save your life, okay? So we're going to keep talking about it, but I'm going to point out the principles. The principles that will help save you and get you to the end. Because ultimately, our home is where? It's not here. So when one of these days it's all burned up, I'm going to look back and say, I hope I did all right on this Bible geography class because I don't really care how deep them wadis are or how salty the salt sea or Dead Sea was. I care about whether or not we understood the principles. Okay? All right, I'll stop. I appreciate your attention. We'll pick back up and get more into 1 Samuel and these other lands.